myths or the fantasies of cohabitation, which really all come down to one point, is that somehow we're going to have a better marriage in the end if we live together first. So let's figure out whether that's the case. Okay, it turns out that there are significant risks to relationships that are associated with cohabitation. Okay, and that is that within a cohabiting relationship, there's more instability and more sense that the relationship is fragile. There's much more of that inside cohabiting relationships. The couples report more, they perceive themselves as having more problems. They develop attitudes that inhibit successful relationships. And most important is that there is a greater probability of divorce for the couple that lives together prior to marriage and then does go on to marry. Now, this result was the result that sent all of the social science guys scurrying back to their computers. Because everybody thought, when they first started studying this in the 80s, everybody thought, oh my gosh, we're going to find out that cohabitation is really a good preparation for marriage and that they're going to have a lower probability of divorce. You know, that if you live together first, you're going to have a lower probability of divorce. That's what people expected. So they were kind of, you know, puzzled by this result, so they went back to study it a bunch. And what they keep finding is that there is a higher hazard rate, what is called a higher hazard rate of dissolution of the marriage if you're a couple who live together. Now, this last point here, you can look at it either of two ways. Some people would tell you serial cohabitation is particularly problematic. That is, the biggest problems happen if you have cohabited with more than one person, if you cohabit with somebody, break up with that person, then go on and have a relationship with somebody else. That fact that you have cohabited is somehow a risk factor for all of your subsequent relationships. But the way some people spin these results is to say, oh gosh, cohabiting isn't so bad if you're married, if you live with one guy and then you go on and marry that guy. Then the problems are not so bad. The risk, the elevated risk is not so high. And so a lot of times when I'm talking on college campuses, the students will raise their hand. Hey, I heard that it doesn't really matter if you are living with the guy that you eventually go on to marry. And I say, well, wait a second. First of all, when you move in with a guy during freshman orientation week and you shack up with them in the dorm, you don't know that that is going to be your one and only episode of cohabitation. In fact, you can be pretty sure that it won't be your one and only episode of cohabitation, right? So it doesn't really get you off the hook to point to this study. The better way, I think, to point to this study is to say that cohabitation is a risk factor. Serial cohabitation is a particular risk factor. And so picking out somebody during freshman orientation week to share a dorm room with is probably not your best long-run strategy. Now, this is the question, the $1,000 question all the students want to know. Is it just a selection effect? Meaning, are those who cohabit somehow systematically different from those who marry? And the students all want to know this because they think that's going to get them off the hook. See, they see all this data and they think to themselves, oh well, that's just all those poor people over there cohabiting. Me, I go to law school, I'm going to have high income and I'm educated, and they think they're going to dodge the bullet. You know, that's basically what it amounts to, and they want to know, is it all a selection effect? And so that's, of course, the first thing that the demographers checked when they kept coming up with this result, and they checked it very carefully. And so what they have found out is that, yes, there is some selection effect, no doubt about it, but it doesn't account for everything. So it's still the case that cohabitors are more likely to be losers, okay? And that, see, that's the other way to turn this argument around on the students who say this. If they say, oh, it's just all a selection effect, you say, well, yes, there is a selection effect. What you're saying is people who cohabit are systematically more likely to be losers, right? So what are you trying to say with this argument? I mean, that you are a loser and that's what accounts for the whole thing? No, they think somehow they're going to dodge that bullet and that's not going to apply to them. So this recent study that I want to call to your attention, this is something that was done in 2003 with US data, and they tested for selection effects, tested pretty closely, and they tested what are called cohort effects. That is it the case that these problems associated with cohabitation are an artifact of the fact that it used to be that cohabitation was for losers, you know, and not socially acceptable? But now some of those effects are going away because it's more socially acceptable, more people are doing it. Maybe cohabitation isn't as bad for us as it would have been for people in the 80s, for example. But it turns out that the answer to both of those questions is no. It's not all selection effects, and the cohort effects are not all diminishing. So just briefly, this is a lot of verbiage up here, but basically what they did was that they looked at people who got married between 1964 and 1980, which is a period when people weren't cohabiting so much, and then they looked at people married between 1981 and 1997, which is a period of much more common cohabitation, and what they found out was that the probability of divorce was, of course, higher in the more recent cohort, right? Of course, 90% higher, but that if you hold constant the cohort, in other words, you take account of the fact that some people were born earlier and some people were born married later, you still have the phenomenon of cohabitors having an increased, very increased probability in the odds of divorce, 151% increase in the probability of divorce. So that's still quite substantial, obviously. And then the other interesting fact is that whether you got married in 1964 or 1997, cohabitors still report lower marital happiness and greater marital instability. That is, if you look at couples and you ask them the question, how do you rate your marriage in terms of stability, in terms of happiness, how happy are you? And then you ask them, did you cohabit before marriage or not? The ones who said we cohabited before we got married will tell you that they have lower levels of relationship satisfaction, lower levels of perceived stability in the relationship. And that's true across the cohorts. That does not go away with the more recent data. So that's a very important indication that the fact that it's becoming socially acceptable is not enough to deal with it. And then the selection bias question, we included this data, included a whole bunch of the obvious things that you would think would matter for probability of divorce. And, you know, education, income, whether your parents were divorced, all those kinds of risk factors. And it's, of course, true that higher education is a protective factor against divorce. There's no question about that. Everybody knows that. But those things do not eliminate the effect of cohabitation on marital happiness, stability, and probability of divorce. Without the control variables, as I mentioned, the odds of divorce are 151%. If you include those control variables, hold constant for income, education, and so forth, the odds of divorce for cohabitors are a mere 77% higher than for non-cohabitors. Now, the complete reference on that, I always put these up in blue slides, so if you want to write down the reference, you know, and get the complete data, the complete picture yourself, this is the complete reference for it, and I can give that to you later. Now, our next topic is, why is cohabitation so disappointing? I hope I've convinced you that cohabitation is a different phenomenon than marriage. So why is it that cohabitation is so disappointing? I have several topics here that I'm going to go over briefly. The oxytocin effect, poorer choice of partner, and then some learned habits. And then finally we'll talk about why not take her for a test drive. Let's talk briefly about oxytocin, which is a hormone that promotes bonding and attachment. And oxytocin is a hormone that women secrete when they are nursing and when they're being sexual. Okay, and so what is happening is that in these two acts, when you're nursing and when you're being sexual, your body relaxes into relationship with the person that you're with. Their body says, relax and connect with whomever you're with. Now, you can see the point of this. You don't have to be, it doesn't matter whether you believe in Darwinian evolution or you believe in creation. It doesn't matter. Either way, it makes sense. You can say a loving God put it in us to make us love our babies and our partners so that we physiologically attach to them. Or if you're a Darwinian, you can say there is obviously survival value to mothers wanting to take care of their babies, and there's survival value to spousal cooperation. So it doesn't matter how you look at it. That's what oxytocin is doing. And it's, I would say, nature's way of building a family, of creating a family and keeping people together. Now, the reason this is important is that when people are cohabiting, they think that they're being rational and they're making a rational, calculated choice. But in fact, their bodies are creating an involuntary chemical commitment. That's in fact what is happening. Their bodies are bonding to one another, whether they're right for you or not right for you, whether the person's good for you or not good for you. People are attaching. to each other. And so they're not nearly so rational in their decision making as they might think. I was once presenting information like this to an audience, and there was a priest, actually it was a Canadian priest. He said to me afterward, he said, you know, this explains something I haven't understood, and that is why people don't break up like they used to. And I'm thinking, Father, people are breaking up all the time. What are you talking about, what people don't break up like they used to? And he said, no. When you're doing marriage preparation, it used to be in the old days, you'd have your 15-page questionnaire, you know, of 1,000 questions to find out if the couple's was compatible or not. And usually somewhere on page 4, you know, somebody would say, whoa, this is a showstopper. We can't get married. We really need to call it off. We shouldn't get married. He says, now you go through that questionnaire, and they go right over those things. You can see, you know, you're sitting there in the counseling chair, you know, you can see this really should be a deal killer, you know, they really shouldn't go on with this, but they go on. They go on anyway, because they're already, in a sense, their bodies have already mated, and it's harder to break up than they may think. And so this is impairing people's judgment about who is a suitable partner for them. This point I develop at more length in Smart Sex, and the whole chapter 2 is really about the physiology of attachment, both at this level at the spousal level, but also at the mother and child level. Now, what this does is impair your choice of partner. That's part of the significance of the oxytocin effect. But this is also something which has been documented by the social science guys, which is that they go out and check, you know, how did you choose your partner and stuff like that. And this is one of the things that they found, is that people take more risks when they're cohabiting. In other words, if you are going to marry somebody, you want somebody who's finished high school, you want somebody who's got employment, earnings. Those things are criteria for marriage. They're not particularly criteria for cohabiting. But if you end up sliding into marrying that guy, right, then you've made a poorer choice. You've chosen kind of a riskier partner in the process, and you didn't even really plan that or think that. You know, that was not a rational thing that you did. Now, the other point, and this is one where I feel I have particular expertise, is that there are certain kinds of learned behaviors. You practice certain things while you're cohabiting. You do certain sets of things. You learn to interrelate in certain kinds of ways that turn out not to be particularly constructive for when you're married, okay? And so these are the kinds of things which social science people have measured, you know, that cohabitors tend to be all of these things. They tend to be less committed to continuing in the relationship. That is to say, they have one foot out the door most of the time. And I think anybody who's lived with anybody knows that feeling, right? That's a reality. That's what it's about. You can sort of feel the guy, you know, kind of creeping toward the door every once in a while. People tend to be more oriented towards their own personal autonomy, and they tend to be less motivated to develop the relationship skills that they're going to need to keep their marriage going. Now, and among married individuals, premarital cohabitation is associated with these kinds of behaviors, that they tend to spend less time together once they're married. I mean, isn't this interesting, this correlation? They spend less time together if they've cohabited before marriage. They have more disagreements. They do less supportive behaviors towards one another. They have less problem-solving behavior. They have more reports of problems. And, of course, they have the greater perception that the relationship is unstable. This is all correlated with premarital cohabitation. And I think that what has gone on is that people have practiced not trusting, right? In other words, they've lived together with this sort of conditional thought in their mind. If it works out, then it works out. If it doesn't work out, I can always leave. And so they're practicing holding back on their partner. They're practicing not giving completely of the self. So that's this, and that's where, again, as I said, I feel I have some expertise in this area, because I could feel that happening as my husband and I moved from our married singles lifestyle towards the situation that really required a lot of cooperation from each other, that there were things we needed to unlearn and some new skills that we needed to be learned. But fortunately, these things can be taught. I mean, supportive behavior can be taught. That's not something we're genetically hardwired to do or not do. You know, I mean, anybody can learn to be more supportive and more positive and so on. And so the little booklet that I have, which I have back there, 101 Tips for a Happier Marriage, is my effort to kind of distill some of those things that turn out to be constructive and helpful. And so the real answer to why not take her for a test drive is that while you're test driving each other, you are practicing things that are really destructive, that you're going to have to unlearn once you get married. And if you think about it, the whole test drive analogy works great if you think of yourself as the driver of the car. But if you think of yourself as the car, it stinks, you know? And the problem is, the car has no feelings about being dumped back at the lot. That's the real core thing. The car has no feelings about being rejected. But people have huge feelings about being rejected, especially in a sexual relationship. And that feeling that you might be rejected colors the whole relationship. It's part of the whole relationship. It's not something that you just happen to feel at the end. It's part of the whole relationship. Now, we should briefly say a little bit more about the hazards to children, because people are often not thinking about kids when they decide to cohabit or not cohabit, but the children do suffer. In addition to the child abuse statistics, which I gave you, which I think are reason enough to be worried about cohabitation, in addition to that, children suffer from poor academic performance, fewer economic resources. The instability in the relationship, as we know, is very difficult on children. And there's a lot of sadness that the kids experience, and loneliness, and loss of self-control even. And a lot of times people try to explain this stuff away by saying, well, if only the cohabiting couples had the same resources. If only the cohabiting mothers weren't depressed. If only stepfathers would spend more time with their children. If only cohabiting boyfriends behaved like married biological fathers. Well, the problem is those big if onlys hardly ever happen, you know. And if people say to us, gosh, you're being very unrealistic thinking people should get married and stay married for a lifetime, I think it's fair to reply, gosh, you're being really unrealistic thinking that a stepfather or a cohabiting boyfriend is going to behave like a married dad. So what should we do? Okay, where does this all leave us? What are our action points here? Well, I think as legislators, and those of you who are involved in the policy process, I think it's important to say we should not encourage cohabitation by treating it as if it were marriage. And I know there are many trends that are pushing towards that. People who are in the courts are in a somewhat different situation because they have to deal with the cases as they see them. But as legislators, I think we can try to make a distinction. And we should also begin constructive dialogue with social workers, with family law attorneys and judges, with psychologists, with the police. A lot of times, at least in the U.S., these groups, social workers and family law attorneys and so on, do not hang around with Focus on the Family people. You know, I think that's safe to say that they don't necessarily see themselves as part of the same coalition. But I think you can start to build coalitions with them, because I'll tell you something. Social workers know perfectly well about the boyfriend problem. Okay, and if you get them privately and you get them in the right frame of mind and you talk to them nicely, get them going, they will give you an earful. They know perfectly well that if they could get the boyfriends out of the house, their caseloads would drop. They know that. So if you can begin some constructive dialogue with them to build some alliances around keeping these distinctions, that would be a good thing. And then finally, we should just remind ourselves, why are we here? What are we in this for? What are our goals? And our goals are really for the children to spend their entire childhood with their own married parents. I think that's what motivates all of us. That's what gets us out of bed in the morning and out to fight the fight, is that we want kids to be spending their whole childhood with their own married parents. And for adults, we want lifelong married love. And I think most people actually want that too. Most people, even in California, if you say, gee, was that fun, your divorce? Would you like to do that again? You know, most people, no. They understand that this was a miserable experience. So lifelong married love is the goal for adults. And for young adults, we would hope that they could enter into their married lives with a little less fear and with a little more hope that it can actually work. And then finally, of course, way down at the bottom of the list, but still important, is that the taxpayer, there are costs to the taxpayer that have to do with making up for the losses of the broken family. So those are the basic reasons why cohabitation is not the same as marriage, why the trends toward cohabitation are destructive of marriage, and I'd now like to stop and invite your questions on any of these topics.
I have two questions, but okay. One of those should be really short. You mentioned for women the bonding hormone, the oxytocin, and I'm wondering, well, what about men? Do they bond to women too? Or is it, you know, why don't the men break up with the women even if the women don't break up with the men? And also, a lot of the effects you talked about are the effects of cohabitation. And I was wondering, is there any research done on people who just have serial sexual relationships without necessarily cohabiting? And how does this apply to them if it does?
Yes, okay. The second question first is actually the shorter one. I don't know if that's the one you meant.
No.
It could be shorter. But serial sexual relationships are correlated with some of these phenomena that we talk about. It's for sure that it's correlated with depression, especially with women. And it's also the case that it's a risk factor for future marital problems. Okay, some of the other problems are not as pronounced, of course, because if you're just, you know, if you're not living with the guy, the domestic violence issue isn't as pronounced and so forth. So that's the answer to that. Now, the male bonding issue, that's a very interesting issue. And I think in our egalitarian age, we always want it to be exactly symmetric. And I'm here to tell you, things aren't exactly symmetric. Okay, men do attach to their sex partners, but they do it in a different way. The physiology of it's different and the meaning of it is different. Okay, and so it's much easier for a man to walk away from a sexual relationship than it is for a woman. And I think, you know, common wisdom, you know, points to that. Or I think everybody knows that. But men do attach. And when men finally do get married, you know, and this is getting married is a big step for a man. And when they do, they are capable of heroic loyalty. And the attachment often will show its face in terms of sexual jealousy and possessiveness. That's kind of the dark side of it. But the bright side of it is that men are capable of heroic loyalty, and we don't give them enough credit for that. About who should break up or not, that's a much more complicated question, which I won't go into. David Blankenhorn wants to say something on this. I
just wanted to say that I know these studies that when men marry and form a bond with their wife, their testosterone level drops.
Yes.
And that's associated with all kinds of good things. Interestingly enough, when they divorce, their testosterone level goes up again. So there's a biochemistry in the male that, as Jennifer points out, is different, obviously, than what happens with women. But the biochemistry of marriage is there in the male, too,
yes.
Primarily, I think, through testosterone.
Yes, and the point of testosterone dropping is that men become less aggressive and stuff like that. And so, you know, when guys lament the fact that their buddy is getting married and you're not going to be one of the gang anymore and so on, that's true. You know, they're right. They're right. He's not going to be one of the gang anymore. He's not going to act the same way. Things aren't going to, you know, different things are going to matter to him and so forth. So that's an important question. Next question.
Hi, I'm Clement Ng with the Center for Cultural Renewal. Thank you for the presentation, by the way. The StatsCan census data you mentioned earlier also shows that cohabitation is rising in popularity among older cohorts, so people above the age of 50 who often previously been divorced and now want to try cohabitation as an alternative. So it seems that we have two populations, these young people in their 20s and 30s who have never been married and are, you know, prepared on their first shot to just cohabit, and then this population of older individuals who have previously been divorced and no longer want to, you know, marry on the second time around. What do we say the second population?
Well, that's a very interesting phenomenon. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you brought that up. Okay, for this reason, it's interesting for a lot of reasons. First of all, I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings here, but we just don't care as much about those old people. You know what I mean? I mean, if they're shacked up, it's not as harmful. They're not going to have babies that they're going to throw against the wall and stuff like that. I mean, you know, we're just not as worried about that group of people. So that's why I didn't talk about it as much. But the second point about it is that for people in that situation, for the 50s and older set, because I saw those stats too, you know, and I thought about that a bit. The over 50 set who are cohabiting, for them, their relationship really almost is a contract. See, it's much closer to see that relationship as a contract. Lots of those guys have, if they do get married, they have prenuptial contracts. And it's much more common at that stage. And what's that about? It's about protecting their assets for their own children. Because they each come into that marriage with a separate batch of children, and they want to be sure that their children are protected. You know, so that is actually closer to a contract than what a young couple would do when they're actually going to build a life and create children in common with each other. So it's socially a very different phenomenon, what those older people do. So, and it's one we're not as worried about. However, the one way in which I think we should be worried about it, and that where we do have something to say, is to say, you know, look, you guys are grown-up people. What kind of example are you setting for the young? You know, what kind of culture are you creating? You know, yes, it might be inconvenient to you to get married, but think of what you're saying to your children by not getting married. You know, and think about whether isn't that worth something to you? You know, to be part of the solution rather than part of the problem. So thank you for that question, because that's a very important phenomenon.
Thank you. We've stolen some of our coffee time here, so I'm going to let this be the last question, and then we'll take a break at this point. So
great.
Hi, Deborah Rankin, Infertility Network of Canada. I'd like to ask you about the differences between cohabitation and marriage on age-related infertility and the use of reproductive technologies to create children.
I don't know anything about that. I don't know if there's more infertility associated with cohabitation. One would think that there might be for this reason, okay, that often the pattern that one sees, particularly among upper-income women, is that they are afraid to get married, or they don't get married for whatever reason. They cohabit as a substitute for marriage, and by the time they finally get around to it, you know, they're 30, they're 35, and so they have more age-related infertility because of that. But there was another part to your question, though. I forgot what it was.
Yes, vis-a-vis the use of reproductive technologies to create a family.
I don't know that cohabiting couples are particularly more or less. I'm just not aware of that. If that has been studied.
Well, there isn't any research in this area, but I thought you might be able to give me a heads up on it, that you might know of something anecdotally. Anyway.
No, afraid not.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll be back at the back offering books and CDs and booklets for sale. So thank you very much.